Good morning, agus fáilte isteach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's This Irish American Life, I am thrilled to be interviewing a good colleague, Fergal McGarry. And Fergal is the co-editor with Patrick Mannion of a really interesting collection of essays on the Irish Revolution in a global context. I actually contributed an essay to this volume. It's published in the Glucksman Irish Diaspora series. It is a wonderful way in terms of locating the War of Independence era in Ireland in the broader context of how Ireland reverberated beyond Irish shores and how other countries and groups looked to Ireland in the context of what was going on as empires were shifting and changing in very dramatic ways. It's one of the first interventions of this type into the recent historiography, and I'm really, really excited to share this interview with you and to have a chat with Fergal about his research and the work that he and Patrick did in terms of bringing together an important dialogue on the global nature of the Irish Revolutionary period. So that will be my chat with Fergal McGarry, to which we will go to now. I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life historian Fergal McGarry, who is one of the co-authors of a new collection, The Irish Revolution, A Global History. It was recently published by NYU Press in the Glucksman Irish Diaspora series. Fergal is an Irish historian specialising in the history of Ireland in the 20th century. He is currently Professor of Modern Irish History at Queen's University Belfast. He has authored books on Ireland in the first half of the 20th century. And he edited this collection with his great colleague, Patrick Mannion. In the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I have made a contribution to this collection, so I'm not entirely unbiased in terms of the content, topic and whole origins of this great collection. First of all, Fergal, welcome. I think this is your first time that I've had you on here on This Irish American Life. Welcome and thank you for taking some time out of your day to have a chat to us. And congratulations on the collection. For the benefit of our listeners, would you tell us a little bit about the background, the origin story of this collection?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me on, Miriam. It's a great pleasure. And it's very appropriate, too, because there's a really important American dimension to this book, to the story it tells. So this book emerges from a wider project, which I ran for about 3.5 years with Enda Delaney, Professor of Irish History at Edinburgh. And it was a project funded by the AHRC in the UK. And it was essentially trying to kind of construct a global history of the Irish Revolution. And we got quite a bit of funding, which allowed us to take on a team of postdoctoral fellows. And I mentioned them here, Dara Gannon and Brian Hanley and Patrick Mannion. They did a lot of the research for the project. And we also organized a lot of research activities, conferences and so on, reflecting on the how the Irish Revolution took shape abroad. And essentially, our project had two key questions. One, how did international and global events shape how the revolution played out in Ireland? And the second question was, how did events within Ireland sort of resonate beyond the island further afield? And just to give some sort of tangible examples of that, the kind of context that we were thinking about is that the Irish Revolution, you know, the War of Independence from 1919 to 1921, plays out during a period of enormous political instability across Europe and indeed across the world. The main context for that, of course, is the aftermath of the First World War. But there's also an important kind of ideological sort of aftermath of the First World War, which is the rise of the idea of self-determination, of national self-determination, that people have the right to rule themselves, that political authority must work in accordance with the consent of the governed. And of course, this idea is coming particularly out of America. It's very much associated with President Woodrow Wilson. And so the other important kind of post-war context is, you know, the fact that most of the empires across Europe have collapsed in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. And so the thing which our project wanted to look at is often the history of the War of Independence is written as if these things are very much in the background. They're interesting, but they're not really perhaps formative in terms of how events in Ireland play out. And we really wanted to try and interrogate the extent to which people are revolutionaries and imperialists in Ireland are very much responding to that kind of wider political and ideological context. And then in relation to the second question, you know, the consequences of what's happening in Ireland, how that resonates abroad, I suppose we were primarily thinking about, you know, the Irish world, the Irish diaspora, and how they shape events in Ireland. And one of the things we were struck by is that there's a kind of a literature which looks at the Irish in different countries, the Irish in the US, the Irish in Canada, New Zealand and so on. But there wasn't really, I think, that much research which kind of looked at connections between Irish people and Irish immigrants overseas and how that sort of played into events in Ireland. So perhaps in our discussion, we'll think of some kind of, you know, we'll discuss some practical examples of that. But they were broadly the two research questions that the project wanted to address. And this book offers a variety of ways of thinking about those questions.
Was there a sense, Fergal, with the project that this approach is innovative in an Irish context in terms of the existing historiography? Mm-hmm. Or has this kind of approach been taken by other historians?
Yeah, I think Ireland was perhaps, I mean, there's been a sort of a global turn in history writing, and you have sort of global histories of all sorts of things, everything's from products to conflicts to different political causes. And that's been quite a, you know, an innovative and important kind of shift in how history is written over the last couple of decades. But I think there was a sense that Ireland was perhaps a little bit, you know, slow to that kind of party. I mean, certainly one book which influenced me was a study by Niall Whelan, which looked at global perspectives in Irish kind of history and very much looked at the idea of transnational approaches to history. And really what's meant by that is the idea that political changes and indeed other changes, they transcend borders. Borders aren't necessarily terribly important. So if we think about all sorts of, I mean, we could think of kind of recent examples of how, you know, financial crises or revolutionary movements, how they kind of spread from country to country. So that kind of global approach was well established, but I think it hadn't been, there hadn't been too much written about it in the Irish context. I mean, another book which I should mention is a history by Maurice Walsh, which did put the Irish Revolution in this global context. But we felt there was a lot more to do. And also one of the reasons why I think this was an approach which suited a research project is that it requires quite a lot of money and effort and sort of input to kind of try and piece together the history of the Irish Revolution without borders. So a lot of the work that we produced as a result of this project was collaborative. So we've worked with close to 100 scholars across the world, producing a number of different outputs. And in a sense, that's the only way you could do a project like this, because you need to be able to draw on kind of international networks, I think. And I still feel with this book, even though we've covered a lot, it's really only scraping the surface. There's really important kind of transnational questions about this period that we didn't look at. I mean, one of the most obvious would be the role of the Catholic Church. I mean, aside from perhaps Irish Republicans in Ireland, I think the Catholic Church is like the key kind of political influence shaping what people around the world think about the revolution, and certainly what Irish Catholics think about it, but also they're a pretty serious kind of player diplomatically and so on. And so even just to write kind of a global history of the Catholic response to the Irish Revolution would be a huge body of work. So I feel we've got a kind of template here, which perhaps could be developed, you know, further. I mean, another area which occurs to me that we didn't really look at and deserves more attention is there's a tendency to focus on Republicans and revolutionaries. It's more interesting. The archives are very good and so on. But, you know, there's also a case for looking more at the imperial side of things and looking at unionism and the Orange Order and so on, because they were also very kind of international movements. So I feel there's a lot more to do with that basic kind of, you know, the basic methods of transnational and global history.
To your point there earlier, Fergal, this type of research is very kind of demanding in terms of resources and expertise, in terms of really doing it properly. It's easy to conceptualize and kind of aspire to, but the practicalities of kind of drilling down in those transnational and comparative ways, as you say, like really lend themselves to something that's hard for like one scholar to do on their own in any systematic way, if you know what I mean. Because we tend to get locked into, as you say, like studying the Irish in North America or in the United States and all these places, and then to kind of pull out the lens a little bit. It's not impossible, as you guys demonstrate so well in this whole project in general, and in particular within this collection, but it needs a little bit of support behind it. Can I ask you then, do you want to maybe speak a little bit, there's a strong American dimension, but you also draw comparisons from other parts of the world. Your own chapter, which you draw a comparison between the efforts of Irish and Korean nationals in this period against Britain and Japan, respectively. Can you tell us a little bit about that research in the context of the wider project, Fergal?
Sure. Yeah. So my essay in this book looks at kind of, I suppose, parallels between Irish and Korean efforts to achieve independence. And how I sort of came to that story was really quite arbitrary, which was I was invited to a conference in Seoul marking the centenary of efforts to achieve Korean independence, which dated to 1919. The first thing which struck me was, you know, why on earth would Koreans want an Irish perspective on this when there's, you know, so many other potential perspectives? But what became kind of very clear was that the Irish efforts to achieve independence, not just were there a lot of parallels in terms of, you know, how they went about that, but actually there was a significant kind of influence, you know, in terms of the Irish revolutionaries being, for a while, 1919, 1920, one of the most high profile, best organized and most kind of effective sort of the revolutionary movements seeking self-determination and therefore getting a lot of attention around the world. So what struck me thinking a little bit about parallels was just, well, first of all, how much there was in common. So a lot of things that Irish Republicans did, I think there was a sense that there was a lot of innovation here and that this was quite sort of distinctive and unique in certain ways. So, for example, they proclaim independence in the spring of 1919. They establish a provisional government. They set up an assembly. They go to the Paris Peace Conference and seek independence. They go to places like America and lobby and so on. They raise loans to float the revolutionary effort. And I was really struck by all of these things were also done by Korean Republicans. They get a little bit less attention because the diaspora is much smaller, and also very importantly, they're less successful in their efforts. But what really struck me was the extent to which there was almost kind of like a revolutionary template, about how in 1919 and 1920 you went about trying to not so much maybe achieve independence as have independence kind of recognized. Revolutionaries everywhere were responding to the same sort of set of circumstances. And the other thing which became very clear is that these revolutionaries worked alongside each other in certain key places. Paris is a really good example. The Treaty of Versailles being negotiated in the first 6 months of 1919. Obviously, all the nationalities who are achieving independence are there, but so also are the Irish, the Indians, the Egyptians, the Koreans, and so on. You know, the groups which aren't being given independence and they're collaborating together in interesting ways. I mean, you could easily sort of over-romanticize it. This is this wonderful kind of revolutionary solidarity. There's all sorts of pragmatism at work too. But it is the case that different republican and revolutionary groups are basically responding in similar ways to the same set of circumstances. Another example would be that after it's clear that these various groups are not going to achieve independence, in a sense that the place where the political power struggle is taking place shifts from Paris to America. In particular to Washington and also to New York. So when you start following these threads, I was quite struck by the way in which Irish Republicans, while they very much lobbied political support from the Irish diaspora, they also cooperated with and collaborated with Indian nationalists, Egyptians and so on, to the extent that it was, you know, mutually within their interests. I guess one thing which is perhaps a little bit novel about the project is that There is a literature on this Wilsonian moment and how across particularly Asian countries, Republican and revolutionary groups responded in very similar ways. An excellent book by Erez Manela, which sort of lays out this territory. I think, though, historians in Ireland were a bit slow to apply this kind of model and this set of kind of questions to Ireland for all sorts of reasons. And there are important distinctions between the Irish case and how they're treated, which maybe we might also talk about. But I think broadly, the Wilsonian moment, that way of thinking about what happens in the post-war moment, does in many respects usefully apply to thinking about trends in Ireland. I mean, the most obvious one being, in a sense, that Wilson appeared to hold out the promise of independence for all these nationalities. And when they didn't receive it, the response was radical and militant and very often sort of transformed into a kind of a military or revolutionary kind of conflict. And then in some cases that ended with sort of political settlements, which gave a degree of independence to the revolutionary movements. And Ireland falls into that, as does Egypt. India has to wait a couple of decades, as does Korea.
Yeah, I think from the New York perspective, Fergal, and you're aware some of the research we did around 1916, and it wasn't specifically New York, but because of our location and things like that, a lot of our research came out of a New York setting. So it tilted that lens a little bit. So we were seeing how important space is. And then I suppose that point marks out as well something I think that has been on your mind in terms of looking beyond 1916. I mean, we find that in when you engage with people who are interested in Irish history in an American context, everyone knows a lot about 1916 usually, or they're very interested. And then there's a little bit of a cliff in terms of kind of what happened. Not that people don't know, but it gets complicated, right? And, you know, and devolves into, like, you know, civil war, which is kind of always difficult. So I suppose the collection here, it provides a bit of a correction in terms of that chronology, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things which really struck me, because I did a lot of work on 1916, I was also very interested in the sort of the global reflections on 1916 and 2016. And it was definitely the aspect of the decade of centenaries that most gripped kind of international and global tension for all sorts of reasons. But what always struck me is that how post-1919, the way we write kind of the history of the War of Independence, it sort of loses that European wartime and wider global focus and shrinks down into something we conceptualize as the War of Independence, which I think we kind of think about primarily as a series of dramatic events in Ireland, you know, typically ambushes like Kilmichael or events like Bloody Sunday. And I was always struck by that the way in which the canvas suddenly narrows. And I think it's like really misleading as a way of thinking about how the Irish Revolution was experienced, whether in Ireland or abroad, and how it was kind of perceived. I think one problem is that naming is framing. Once we talk about a war of independence, we kind of think about a military struggle, you know, in which IRA flying columns take on British Army forces and Black and Tans and so on. But I mean, it makes much more sense as historians are aware to think about the War of Independence as a revolutionary conflict. So it's a political struggle. It's a revolutionary struggle, which involves kind of mass mobilization of people, of workers, of trade unions. It involves propaganda, domestic and international. And really, you could go as far as saying that the military dimension of the War of Independence, which we focus so much on, is primarily kind of symbolic. It's a sort of a form of armed propaganda. Really, the really strong weapon that Irish Republicans have is their ability to internationalize the conflict, to project it onto the global stage, and to essentially kind of embarrass Britain internationally. And I think Britain plays into this in terms of how it responds to the insurrection in Ireland. I mean, a classic example would be the forming of the Black and Tans and the auxiliaries, which interestingly were partly because of international and global pressures on the British Empire and imperial crisis spanning everywhere. They didn't actually have the British troops to suppress the conflict in more conventional ways. But, I mean, what happens when the Black and Tans start burning down places like Balbriggan and Cork is a little bit like Easter 1916. Suddenly it's global news. It's really closely followed in places like America. And I think Republicans are really effective at understanding that the strength of their ability to project the conflict internationally. For example, if you look at with the Declaration of Independence in January 1919, again, we tend to think of that as quite a Dublin-centred event, but all the key documents that are proclaimed that day, the Declaration of Independence, the message to the free nations, the democratic programme, they're incredibly international in how they're kind of framed. There's an understanding that to be successful against a superior political and military superpower, that you need to internationalize the conflict. And of course, there's some parallels there with how the Troubles plays out and comes to an end in the 1990s.
What struck me a lot in terms of some of that work in 1916 and actually the lead up to 1916, Fergal, I mean, you know, you're much more in the trenches than I am in terms of some of this history, perhaps, but how things are evolving on the ground in Ireland is not matching necessarily at all times, especially things like public opinion. Like 1916, you know, for example, like as I argue in the introduction to that Ireland's Allies collection, the Wooden Bridge speech and Redmond in 1914. I mean, the impact that had in Irish New York in terms of swaying people from people who had been diehard constitutional nationalists for years, making them a lot more radical, was very, very interesting to think about in the context of responses in Ireland at the same point in time. And I suppose that observation, I don't know whether you agree with, but it brings me to kind of one of the really key points I think that this collection brings out is how this perspective, this global perspective, allows us to see more easily themes that are less central in the Irish context. And I suppose the good example that I have with my own chapter on Marcus Garvey, and I think David Brundage's on Du Bois, the question of race and how that frames all some of these activities and engagements is just not existent in Ireland context in the way that we can plot out in the diaspora or in a specific US context. So that kind of changing the focus and allowing us to see how certain themes take on a greater importance beyond Irish borders is very significant in the collection.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's sort of, it goes back to the difficulty of writing a kind of global history of Irish revolution, because you start, it's like peeling an orange. You know, there's so many different layers. And I think the key thing is that the Irish question looks different depending on where you are and from what perspective you're at. So, I mean, we think of Irish Republicans being kind of maybe socially conservative and very Catholic. And we know that the state that comes out of the Irish Revolution is very gendered and conservative and Catholic. But if you look at the Irish diaspora in places like Britain and America, I mean, they're to the forefront in trade unions. there's, as well as having conservative groups like the Ancient Order of Hibernians and so on, we have all these kind of manifestations of radicalism, including what your article brilliantly brings out, and also David Brundage's work. David looks at how W.E.B. Du Bois, how he sort of interpreted the Irish question. What you can see is that really, depending on where you end up, you can have completely different views of Irishness, and also people looking at the Irish question will read into it what they will. So another kind of really interesting strand I think that this book brings out is that, you know, revolutionaries everywhere look at other revolutions in a way that's useful for their cause. So for example, in our book, Donal Hassett looked at how Algerians interpreted and reinterpreted the Irish question. Now, they're not doing that in a very kind of accurate or realistic way, but it doesn't matter. They're sort of making the case that what the Irish we can do. Anna Lively has a very similar essay when she looks at links between Ireland and Russia and how both sides are, you know, viewing each other's movements. And Martin Frampton also looks at parallels between how Egyptian and Indian nationalists turn to a kind of a politics of cultural nationalism as a way of rejecting imperialism. And again, that maps quite nicely onto themes. So, I mean, one of the really interesting things I think that this book brings out, and it's been well established, but the Irish Revolution gives a nice focused way of looking at it, is that there are different varieties of Irishness around the world. So, I mean, you mentioned the American example, which is obviously the most, maybe the most revolutionary and the most Republican. It seems to me that they're almost like a few years ahead of that curve where you get the shift from home rule to republicanism. It happens more quickly and more strongly in America. But if you compare the Irish in the US to, say, the Irish in Australia or New Zealand, you get a very different kind of take on the Irish question. The Irish in Australia and New Zealand are reasonably happy with their integration into those societies. They're reasonably successful. They don't see any particular reason why some kind of support for home rule can't be combined with the ability to be loyal citizens of those British dominions. So it goes back to that very interesting question of perspectives. And I guess in a useful way that kind of decenters what it means to be Irish and ideas of, you know, what Irish Republicans are struggling to achieve. I think one of the really interesting kind of tensions that you see in America is between Irish Republicans such as De Valera, who go over to America with a very clear sense of what they want to achieve in terms of Sinn Féin's interest in Ireland, and Irish Americans who have a different set of considerations, which is to do with how they see their place in the US. And, you know, an obvious example of that would be, you know, Irish Americans are very much opposed to the idea of the League of Nations and the idea of that kind of sharing of sovereignty. Whereas for Irish people within Ireland, Irish entry into the League of Nations is a very kind of attractive thing. And that becomes, you know, one of those fault lines which really produces very acrimonious, you know, relations between certain Irish Americans and Irish in America.
It's a wonderful collection, Fergal. Well done to yourself and Patrick Mannion. I'm sorry Patrick can't be with us today, but we'll have other opportunities down the line, no doubt, to chat to him too. It's called The Irish Revolution, A Global History. It's published by NYU Press in the new but already making waves collection, series rather, the Glucksman Irish Diaspora series, as founded by the great historian who's inspired my work and I know yours, Fergal Professor Kevin Kenny. Keep up the good work, Fergal. You're always very productive and we really appreciate you taking time out of a busy schedule to chat to us on this Irish American life this morning. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Miriam. Great to talk to you.
For the second half of today's programme, folks, I'm delving into the archives and I'm sharing with you a very interesting interview which I undertook a number of years ago with the Irish psychologist, mental health activist and former politician Joan Freeman. Joan was a founder of Pieta House, a suicide intervention charity established in 2006 in Dublin. It's known, the entity is known as Solace House in the United States, and it offers an amazing array of services for people who are struggling in some way in terms of mental health and needing some support. Many of you may be familiar with the Darkness into Light initiative, which runs every year to support this wonderful organization. And I had the good fortune a few years ago of sitting down with Joan to talk to her about the context in which this charity was established, what inspired her, why the need was there, and what has had been done up to that point in terms of providing support to people. It's gone from strength to strength in terms of services. I know in the New York City area in particular, the services which are based at the New York Irish Center in Long Island City provide really invaluable support to people, and it's always very important to make people aware of the services that are out there for people when they're in need. Joan has had a remarkably interesting career herself and background, and it was wonderful to have an opportunity to hear kind of up close and personal how the evolution of an organisation of this nature, I suppose in one way it makes you think about how small changes and how one person and an idea can be impactful in terms of the lives of others. Solace House was launched in New York City actually in 2015. It's remarkable to think that it's actually in the landscape of Irish New York now for, what, 7 years? That feels like a blink of an eye. I thought it was only a few years in the city. So it goes to show it's definitely part and parcel of the organisational topography of Irish New York, as well it should be. So as I said, for closing out this week's programme, I wanted to delve into the archives and pull out something rather interesting to share with you all and to remind you of the important work of this organisation. So I'll hand over now to the archives and to an interview with Joan Freeman. Enjoy this now, folks. Thanks again for tuning in. I'm delighted to welcome Joan Freeman, who's here with us by way of Pieta House in Ireland and more recently offering the service of Pieta House here in New York. And we're delighted to have the opportunity to have a chat about historically the great work that you and Pieta House have done, and I suppose let people know as well that the service is available in New York. Tell me, Joan, is this your first time in Luxman Ireland House?
No.
Oh, you've been here before?
I feel such a veteran over here, and not only, I've been about three or four times here in Luxman House.
Good, okay.
But I can get around the city on the subway, and I'm going around telling everybody how fabulous I am, because I know how to do the subway in New York City.
Well, it's no mean feat, Joan.
So
I'm not introducing you for the very first time here. I'm glad to hear that, but I'm delighted this is your first time on our radio hour. I know that you've been on with Adrian in the past, but we're delighted to welcome you to our programme. So would you mind, Joan, telling us, for the benefit of our listeners who aren't familiar, as someone who's from Ireland and keeps connected with things in Ireland, I know about Pieta House, but some of our listeners may not. And can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of Pieta House in Ireland, and then maybe we'll talk about the New York setting?
Sure, yeah. So, as you said, I'm from Dublin, I'm from Ireland, and I'm also a psychologist. I had 12 years ago, I had my own little practice in Dublin, and it was very handy because I could work the hours I wanted to work. I had four children. So when my kids were at school, I'd do a few hours. When they're in bed, I would do a few hours. But it also meant I could pick and choose the people I wanted to help. And if anybody came to me who was suicidal or self-harming, I'm so ashamed to admit it, but I would send them off very quickly to their local doctor or to the emergency room, very relieved that I didn't have to have them on my patch. Because as far as I was concerned, someone who was suicidal or self-harming was either mad, or not only did I feel that they were a danger to themselves, but possibly to me. And not only do I look back with great shame on during that time, but I suppose I was a product of Catholic Ireland as well, because, you know, we would have used suicide as a sin. I mean, even the word, when people say commit suicide, it conjures up the word sin or a crime. So when my own sister took her life, she was 52, and she had four children. You can imagine my whole idea of suicide and the understanding of suicide was shattered. Basically, I closed down my own practice and I started to research suicide. What would make someone take their life? And when I think back, I mean, Pieta's 10 years old now, so we're talking about 12, 13 years ago. Believe it or not, I had no internet in the house. So, and that's so hard to believe when we think of mobile phones and everything. But every day I would book an hour in the local library on their internet, on their computer, and I would type in the word suicide, hoping that some explanation would come up for me, and that really that I would discover that nobody could save anybody's life, that my sister's life couldn't have been, her death couldn't have been prevented. And basically the opposite came up. Most suicides can be prevented. In the case of my sister, which is really reflects what happens with many suicides, is that she was reacting to a life event. And this was even more confirmed for me when Ireland went through the recession a few years ago. As soon as the recession hit Ireland, the suicide rates went up with farmers and people in construction industry who were worst affected. So that took me on a journey of further research. Where would I, if my sister was alive, where would I like to bring her? What sort of help would she need? And then the concept of Pieta House came up. And really, it is the alternative to the emergency room. But this is, our role is to prevent people from going to hospital. It is to carry them through their crisis, and crisis can be short-lived. And to stop viewing people as having serious mental health issues, when in fact, all that's happening is that they're reacting to a particular life event in their life.
So it would be fair enough to say, Joan, that it, you know, up to that period of 10, 12 years ago, there really was very little in terms of support services for people who ended up in your sister's situation outside of an emergency room.
There was the emergency rooms or a psychiatric hospital. There was nothing else. And people, it wasn't just me, even though I beat myself up now, but most people in my position, in the clinical position, would have felt the same way, that this was a medical problem, that it wasn't a social problem, that it wasn't a problem of emotional distress, it was a medical problem. Ireland is now a very different country. We view suicide so differently. Now the first call of action would be to send someone to Pieta House. When you think about how people would have suffered sitting in emergency rooms for hours and hours at a time, and most of the time then would leave before they were seen to. So everything has changed. People's whole concept of suicide has changed, and people are no longer afraid to look for help.
As you're talking, I'm a historian, Joan, by profession, and as you're talking, you know, part of me thinks, and I love your insights, because I'm sure you probably at least have some reflections or have thought about it. There's probably, you've pointed to like higher rates of suicide in terms of times of economic crisis and things like that. But do you think that generally, you know, suicide is more common now than it was in the past, or is it just more acceptable as a hard term because it's awful for the family and people involved in suicide naturally? But, you know, in the past in Ireland, it was a great shame, as you referenced. People weren't sometimes given Catholic burials, or and they were, you know, not buried in consecrated ground and all this stuff. But in terms of the historical stuff, has it really elevated in terms of a practice?
I suppose basically what you're asking is, have we normalised suicide? Yeah, and the answer is absolutely not. Suicide is not the normal reaction to a life crisis. When someone goes to take their life, it's because they see no other option. They actually don't want to die. They just want to stop this terrible pain. What has happened from a historical perspective is that years ago nobody spoke about it. It wasn't being documented because of that stigma, because they would be afraid that the person wouldn't be buried on hallowed ground. And if you think back, well, we can't think back, but if we talk again about historically, suicide was perfectly normal. Up until the 5th century, it was perfectly normal. In fact, I think there was a group of young men called the Dolomites, or something like that, the Dolo something. And they truly believed that if they took their light, they'd get to heaven far more quickly. And so it was the done thing to do. It was, oh, this is terrible. When, you know, when you get to my age, you start forgetting names. But anyway, it became sort of a creed that this was not allowed to happen. That it became part of the church's ruling that you do not take your life. Because what was happening was that all these young men were dying. And that quickly became enmeshed into criminal law as well. So if you attempted to take your life, not only was this against the church, but it was also against the land. And your belongings, whether you survived or not, would be taken off you. And this really originally was to prevent people from taking their life. They're trying to scare them out of taking their life. Now, this practice still goes on today, as we know, suicide bombers, again, who believe that they are going to getting a direct pathway to heaven if they do this, whatever, you know, for whatever reasons behind it. So that taboo and stigma has absolutely stuck to us ever since. I mean, even to this day, if someone dies by suicide, a family member would often say to me, do you think they've gone to heaven? Because they're terrified that they haven't. So what's happening now compared to years ago, first of all, people are talking about it. People would come up to me and say that their brother died 40 years ago and they've never spoken about it to anybody. So we haven't normalised it. What we have done is we've given people permission to talk, but permission to seek help, and that's the most important thing.
Where exactly Pieta House is, and how, I imagine over the 10 years of its existence, even in Ireland, and it's wonderful to know that it's. I feel like there's probably a great need in the Irish American community for something like this as well, and we'll get to that. But tell me a little bit about the Pieta House as it kind of evolved 10 years ago, and maybe how it's changed or not in terms of that decade.
So 10 years ago we opened our first centre, which was in a little village in Lucan on the outskirts of Dublin, not knowing what we were going to face, not knowing whether people would come or not. And that first year we saw 70 people. So last year we would have seen over 6,000 people. We would have seen children as young as 6 years of age to people in their 80s. That one centre started off, as I said, in Dublin. We have now 9 in Ireland. A 10th one is opening up in the next couple of months. Our 11th one, or 10th one, was in New York a few months ago. It has become, of course, the service is free of charge. It's run by qualified psychotherapists or psychologists. It's not a drop-in. It's a therapeutic model that we created to help people in suicidal crisis. So this is a centre of excellence, a clinically proven method that works very, very well. We started off with 2 part-time and 2 full-time staff. We now have 180 staff. We've been asked by all over the world for advice. So I'm just back from Iceland, where suicide rates are 4 times that of Ireland, even though they've only got a population of 330,000 in their country. And while I offered to help them set up something for them that would be exclusively for them, they want the Pieta way. They see our organisation and our service as something that's proved to work exceptionally effectively. And I suppose the compassion is probably the cornerstone which attracts nearly every country. The fact that suicide before has been seen in a cold light, as I said, as a stigma and taboo. Now people are looking at that this should be handled with great respect and compassion.
So tell me then, Joan, when and how did it happen that there was felt to be a need for Pieta House to come to New York?
Well, it happened really by accident. We have an annual fundraiser, which is also an awareness campaign called Darkness into Light. And what that is, it's a 5K walk that starts at 4 o'clock in the morning and finishes just as the dawn is breaking, which is about an hour later. So our first one was about 7 years ago. and we had in the Phoenix Park, and 400 people turned up that morning, which, again, we were gobsmacked. Last year, 130,000 people walked across Ireland. So Ireland has just completely embraced everything about Piazza, about what it does and what it is trying to do. And we've become quite, we've got leadership qualities as far as suicide is concerned now, because so many other countries want to do the same thing. So I got a request asking, could we have Darkness into Light in New York by the New York Irish Centre? A young woman called Rebecca Sked emailed me one day and she said, could we please have Darkness into Light here? And I said, of course, started talking to them about it. And the next thing, they started talking about, what about having a service over here, specifically for the Irish? The Department of Foreign Affairs heard about it and asked us, would we do it? So they gave the grant of $90,000 to come over. While we said, yes, we're looking at the Irish over here, it's important that we look at everybody, that we could never turn anybody away. We had our first Darkness into Light in New York, and 1,000 people turned up last May. So this year we are in 5 venues in America, 2 places in New York, we're in San Diego, Chicago, Washington, and where else? We got permission to walk across the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, so, which is just great, because that bridge is known as a bridge of tragedy, where people from all over the world come over to take their lives, and now we're turning it into a bridge of hope. So again, the Irish, this is, I suppose I'm getting the biggest kick out of the fact that I'm Irish, and that the Irish are bringing this to the world, and that's just such a wonderful thing to think about, you know. So anyway, so one word borrowed another, and so we were asked, could we open? So we opened just the end of September, and we're hoping to have another outreach place in New York so that we can cover as much of New York as possible. So we're in Long Island City, Jackson Avenue. So we're looking at another maybe very highly populated area in Woodlawn, which in fact this evening I'm going to see a site there, and we'll just see what happens then.
Through that, you'd probably, Joan, tap into, or do you, I mean, how does that work exactly in terms of, would you tap into pre-existing networks of support and absolutely, individuals and organisations, yeah, in the community?
That's exactly it. So we'll make connections with the Jewish Board, the Catholic Charities, because they're the two biggest providers of services in New York. But the funny thing is, I got a visa last week, and the only way I could get a visa was if I was bringing something to this country that it doesn't already have. So they accept that Pieta does not exist over in America.
Oh, really?
The type of service, wow. Yeah.
So you really weren't inspired by, as such, another model. You know, sometimes, you know, we kind of were good at, and I think Irish people do a good job of that, of kind of going places and adapting things to an Irish context. But this is really something that's come out of Ireland, is the opposite.
This is so out of Ireland. And I suppose people want to know, why do I call it Pieta House? So that magnificent sculpture by Michelangelo of Mary holding the dead broken body of her son is really what inspired me on a personal level, because that image would resonate across Ireland of mothers holding the dead broken bodies, the young men that have died by suicide. And I suppose it was one of those light bulb moments when I thought, we need to have a living Pieta in every community where we can hold the broken lives of people who are in distress. So it's fully blown and grown Irish. It's great. The thing was, mine was just a thought. It was the Irish people who then grabbed it and nurtured it. Because if you think about it, it costs about 6 million, nearly 7 million this year, to run the Pieta houses across Ireland. We will receive about 500,000 from the government. The rest is from the people of Ireland.
It strikes me, Joan, just in my own community in at home in Wicklow, that you know, the Darkness into Light walks have been done there, and it's, unfortunately, it's the case that so many lives have been touched, either friends or relatives, by suicide, that it's really, you just came at a great moment in terms of harnessing that need for people to feel like they can reach out to others and maybe prevent it happening again in the future, right, and to raise awareness. Does Pieta House
support both family? Is it only for the person in crisis, or does it extend beyond that?
It certainly is for the person in crisis, but it's also for the family who has a person in crisis. Because what do you do? You know, what do you know what to do? And in fact, for the family, it's usually so much more difficult because you're helpless and you feel hopeless and you're living in fear. You're on permanent alert all the time. And the reality is, if we don't work with the family in collaboration, then this is not going to work at all. Because while a person will come to us, and if they need to every single day come to us while they're in crisis, that's for 1 hour. What happens to the other 23 hours? So the family is supported and guided and advised what to do in this situation. And that's why it works.
Do you know how do Irish suicide rates, it's probably hard to compare just the sheer expanse of the population and the size, but do you have any sense of how are Irish suicide rates, say, comparable to those in the United States, or do you have any data on that?
Well, we came up, first of all, a couple of years ago. We did some analysis on our own attendance, people attending our services, and we discovered that 53% of people come to us were women, or were females. 47% were male. And we were clapping ourselves on the back because we thought, God, you know, men are rubbish at looking for help and all this sort of thing. And then when we sort of did a little bit of deeper analysis, we discovered, in fact, that it was the women who made the appointment for the men. Mm. So that was the first thing. The second thing we discovered was that there were two tipping points for men that would tip them over to consider taking their lives. One was anything to do with work. Hence, when the crisis hit us, men took their lives because either their business failed or they were made redundant, or and their whole identity was shaken. And the second tipping point we discovered was the ending of a relationship. Men find it, as they get older, increasingly difficult if a relationship ends, because they need the emotional support from their partner. And we thought, again, how clever we were discovering all this, because we're listening to live people. This isn't post-mortem analysis. This is, you know, information we're getting the moment someone comes into us. Our first question to them is, why do you want to die? And our second question is, why do you want to live? So we were having real information. And when we looked at them, we discovered what was the tipping points of men. We saw that it was exactly the same across the world. So it is usually the same problems in America, across the world. The thing with the Irish over in America, there's more of a sense of isolation. At home, at least you have some support system, regardless of how small it is. Here, and from living here for 3 months, and New York is fabulous, but I've never felt so alone in all my life. And that's because of the vast numbers of people and because they don't have those hubs, that support system, even though the Irish are very good to each other over here. But that's all right when you're here for a few years. When you're here at the beginning, it's extremely lonely. And that wouldn't help if someone's over here, that sense of isolation.
Joan, I think I know the answer to this question, but I will finish up by asking you, I don't think you miss private practice, do you? You don't miss what you did before?
No, absolutely not. I'd never be able to go back to it. And I suppose it was because of my sister. I could never sit in a room with someone and not be thinking of her. So I could never go back to that. But when I think of all the amazing people that I'm meeting, that I wouldn't have met if I was still in private practice, so I don't miss it at all.
But it strikes me that it was because of your professional background in, you know, colliding with this very personal event, right? I mean, if you did something else for a living, do you think you might have ended up doing this anyway or no? I mean, I know that's like a what if question, but it's like,
it's a very interesting question. And in fact, it's funny you should say that. I'm sure your listeners know of Mary Harney, who used to be the Minister for Health. So the first time I ever met her, and I just started Pieta House, her first question to me was, are you a psychologist? Now, if I had said no, if I had said I was a bookkeeper, I wouldn't have been taken seriously. And I think it's because of my clinical background that they did take me and the whole concept of the Ada House seriously. And when you think of all the hundreds of people across Ireland who have lost someone, who have tried to set up something, like a mother who's lost a child, who might want to set up, you know, a helpline or something. If they don't have that clinical background, if they're not embraced by someone who can support them in that, then Ireland is missing out on a very credible experience of a person who's lost someone through suicide and who knows some of the answers now.
In a crude sense, I don't know whether you attempt to do that at all, Joan. Like the Pieta House framework must have saved now thousands of lives.
It has. You know, to be perfectly honest, it has. And even in New York, it mightn't seem a huge amount just yet, but we haven't even pushed the service. We've seen 12 people in the last week who were quite critical, who couldn't, either didn't have health insurance or who wouldn't use that because of what it might mean on their record. So I know we're tapping into something that's really powerful here. But to be honest, you know, when you talk about a framework, none of this would be possible at all if people didn't have the courage to come to us in the first place. There'd be no service.
Well, listen, Joan, it's really wonderful to have this opportunity and indeed an honour to sit down and have an opportunity to talk to the person who was behind all this and in such desperately sad circumstances that you've turned it around in such a lovely way and continue to be a great ambassador for us. Unfortunately, we wish in a way that this wasn't needed, right, that we didn't need things like this, but to see, and again going back to me putting my historian's hat on, Joan, thinking about that legacy and history of the Irish in terms of going out into the world, and particularly thinking historically of the members of the religious orders who, you know, get a lot of bad press these days for various reasons and things like that. But there has been this huge legacy and history of the Irish and social activism and help and caring for the others, which I think is probably deeply ingrained in the history of Christianity in the country. And for us not to throw the baby out with the bathwater as such, which you're exemplifying in such a beautiful way. So thanks, Joan. I hope that we meet you again and hear more about Pieta House, and for any of our listeners to know that that service is available here and to support where possible here. It's great that people have a way now to be part of the Darkness into Light initiatives as well. So thank you so much. I know you're busy here on your trip here. Thank you for taking time out to come in and chat
pleasure
to us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you, Miriam.
This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.